This is DW News, live from Berlin. Islamic State militants blow up a landmark mosque in Mosul. The Grand Al-Nouri Mosque was one of Islam's most important sites. The Iraqi Prime Minister says by destroying it, Islamic State is admitting defeat. Also coming up, Uganda has one of the most generous refugee policies in the world, but the huge influx of people fleeing the conflict in neighboring South Sudan is testing the limits of tolerance. And
I mean, actually, think of it. The higher it goes, the more valuable it is. It's like pretty good imagination, right? Good. My idea.
U.S. President Donald Trump outlines an unexpected new plan for a proposed wall in Mexico. Is his idea good or not? I'm Sarah Kelly. Welcome to the program. Islamic State militants have blown up an iconic mosque in the Iraqi city of Mosul. The Al-Nouri Mosque and its famous minaret were a symbol of the city for more than 800 years. Now, it was also the place where IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared the caliphate 3 years ago. IS destroyed the buildings as Iraqi forces battling to retake the city closed in on the site.
They were two of Mosul's most famous landmarks. But now, the medieval Al-Nouri Mosque and its leaning Al-Habda Minaret that had stood for more than eight centuries have been destroyed by the so-called Islamic State. The Iraqi army was advancing on IS-held territory in the city's old town. Its soldiers were within 50 meters of the mosque when jihadist fighters blew it up. Initially, Islamic State leadership issued a statement blaming a U.S. strike, a claim that was immediately and vehemently denied. The Al-Nouri Mosque holds great significance for the IS jihadists. In 2014, their leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared himself caliph there, ruler of all Muslims, and announced his self-styled caliphate spanning parts of Syria and Iraq. Since then, the black IS flag has been flying from the mosque's iconic leaning minaret. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi tweeted early Thursday, the IS bombing of the Al-Habda Minaret and the Al-Nouri Mosque is a formal declaration of their defeat. The fight to free Mosul from IS has now been going on for 8 months, and the jihadists are on the retreat. Coalition forces have backed the last IS fighters into a small part of the old city in the narrow streets around the mosque they just destroyed.
For more, let's bring in now Florian Neuhoff, who is standing by in Erbil in Iraq with the very latest. So, Florian, what are we to make of IS's strategy in destroying this mosque in particular? Could it really be the beginning of their defeat in Mosul, as has been speculated?
It is for sure symbolic of their defeat or their inevitable defeat in Mosul. As the report has pointed out, the Islamists, the jihadists have been hemmed into the historic core of Mosul, which is just a square mile, and in recent days, Iraqi special forces have made significant inroads into that last bastion of the Islamic State. However, it would be a mistake to think that the defeat is imminent. It's certainly not a matter of days. There's still a lot of hard fighting to be done to eliminate the jihadists in this very difficult terrain.
And now this battle to retake Mosul, we have known that it was not going to be an easy one. What challenges remain for the Iraqi coalition that are pushing into the city at the moment?
Well, the historic core, the old city of Mosul, is a labyrinth of very dense, narrow alleyways and old houses, which on one hand could be very thick walls, but also could collapse very easily. There are still probably several hundred ISIS fighters who are holding out there. This is a much higher concentration of jihadists than you would have had in most other parts of the city, which also took a very long time, often weeks to take. On top of that, there are still tens of thousands of civilians which are held in the old city by ISIS, which have immediately been used as human shields, which means that the coalition cannot bring its overwhelming firepower from the air and from the ground to bear on the jihadist defenders, which makes it more difficult to advance, and which also obviously causes a very huge humanitarian problem.
Absolutely, a strategy that we have seen the Islamic State utilize before. Thanks so much for reporting, Florian Neuhoff, joining us from Erbil. We apologize for the quality of the sound from your telephone, but nonetheless, we're happy that we got to get some perspective from you. Meantime, in other news, following a spate of recent terror attacks in Europe, security and defense issues will be topping the agenda today when EU leaders meet in Brussels for a two-day summit. France's President Emmanuel Macron will be in the spotlight at his first EU summit since winning the presidency. He's been vocal about closer cooperation between Germany and France. And Britain's Theresa May will be attending the meeting just a few days after the UK and the EU held their first formal Brexit discussions. But as I said yesterday, let's get more on this summit. We're joined by our correspondent, Georg Matthes, who is standing by with the latest from Brussels. So, Georg, what do you make of Macron's push for closer cooperation between Germany and France? I mean, can he give the Franco-German relationship some new momentum here?
I would say that is at least the hope of the twin engine, the twin motor that has been driving so many EU initiatives. So both France and Germany really hope that that will be the case. Clearly, Macron was paid his first maiden visit abroad to Angela Merkel. They've had a number of phone conversations, I've learned from diplomats, ahead of this summit. And earlier this month, the EU channeled a blueprint for a European defense fund, a German-French initiative that aims to see more cooperation in the defense sector, eventually potentially even creating a headquarter and establishing the European Union as a as a power player at a time when you have President Donald Trump who says it's America first and it's Europe second, if you want it this way. So, yes, there is quite a bit of momentum here in the European Union that they look towards this twin engine, and we'll see how it goes, how the idea of this military fund goes down with the other leaders today.
Yeah, and Georg, that sounds quite optimistic there, actually, your assessment. I mean, is that indicative of the atmosphere going into this meeting today? Are there signs of unity like this?
Donald Trump, the head of the European Council, wrote in his letter, at the beginning of the letter, invitation letter to this summit, that the EU is slowly turning the corner. And if you compare that to all the other invitations letters in the past 2 years, which were full of all sorts of problems, it's quite a different tone. There's a lot of agreement on a number of subjects. If you look at counterterrorism, if you look at Russian sanctions, if you look at the Paris climate deal, all these non-contentious issues. There will be a bit of haggling, particularly on the issue of relocation, in two aspects here. I think the relocation, the really big question on refugees, I think that leaders will leave to the side. There's still a solid row on how to relocate people by a quota. But there will be an interesting debate on the relocation of the EU agencies in the UK, which after Brexit will have to be relocated to the rest of Europe. And clearly, everybody has at least signaled that they are more than happy to take them.
Meantime, Georg, the elephant in the room, Brexit negotiations, which started on Monday. To what extent is Britain's departure from the bloc on the agenda, though, today?
Leaders literally, Sarah, will have Brexit for dessert. So after dinner, Theresa May will give a short speech. She's expected, some diplomats say, she's expected to make a generous offer to resolve the EU citizens' dilemma in the UK. There are other diplomats who told me ahead of this meeting that that is not likely to be the case because it's more proper to leave that to the Brexit negotiations. And that will be the key part once Theresa May has left the meeting after dinner, where Michel Barnier, the chief Brexit negotiator, will give the EU leaders a briefing on the current state of play of the Brexit talks.
Georg Matthes in Brussels. Thank you. Germany's parliament has been paying tribute to the late Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who died last Friday at the age of 87. It's the start of a series of events to mark the passing of the statesman, widely seen as the father of German reunification. Now, German Parliament President Norbert Lammert said that Kohl embodied his country's hope for life in a free Europe. He also said that without him, the dream of German reunification may not have become a reality.
A politician who does not aim for a piece of utopia is a poor man, a young Helmut Kohl told Spiegel magazine in 1968. That was still possible at the time. The fact that the unity of Germany and Europe was not a utopia came down to his obstinacy in questions of principle and his decisive grasp of the concrete historical situation. In 1989, Kohl demonstrated a farsightedness which had long since been lost in the western part of the divided country. Kohl knew that this great national goal could only be achieved through the unification of Europe. But the Union of European States was never only a means to this end. It was an end of its own, a peace project on the formerly war-torn continent. He tried to make this irreversible at the end of his tenure by means of the common currency.
Let's get a quick check now of some other stories making news around the world. U.S. police are investigating an attack on a police officer in Flint, Michigan as an act of terrorism. They have charged a Canadian man who's alleged to have stabbed the officer in the neck at an airport. He reportedly shouted, Allahu Akbar, the Arabic phrase for God is the greatest. The officer is recovering in the hospital. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has urged China to apply greater diplomatic and economic pressure on North Korea to rein in its nuclear weapons program. Tillerson called North Korea the top security threat to the U.S. He made the remarks after a meeting of top U.S. and Chinese diplomats and defense chiefs in Washington. In Chile, police clashed with protesters who are demanding improvements to the nation's higher education system. Education in Chile is prohibitively expensive for many students and often leaves students with crippling debts. The protesters are calling on Chile's president, Michelle Bachelet, to deliver on promises before her term ends next year. Donald Trump may be under fire in Washington, but he received a warm welcome from supporters at a rally in Iowa on Wednesday. The U.S. president appeared to be back in campaign mode at the event, saying that he was succeeding in the role against all odds. Trump also pitched an idea for his planned border wall with Mexico. Have a listen.
We're thinking about building the wall as a solar wall so it creates energy and pays for itself. And this way, Mexico will have to pay much less money. And that's good, right? Is that good? You're the first group I've told that to. It's solar wall. Makes sense. Let's see. We're working it out. We'll see. Solar wall panels. Beautiful. I mean, actually, think of it. The higher it goes, the more valuable it is. It's like... pretty good imagination, right? Good. My idea.
In fact, the idea of a solar paneled wall has been around for quite a while. Just a little fact checking there. It was even included in pitches submitted to the U.S. government earlier this year. Here's the solar panel design from the Las Vegas firm Gleason Partners. The company said that the generated electricity that the wall would pay for itself in about 20 years or less. Sound familiar? Trump supporters think that the Democrats will have a hard time opposing the idea. Scott Pressler says, I can't wait to see Democrats protest Trump's solar panel wall. The Dems are so unhinged that they will protest green energy. But opponents of the wall say that misses the point. Shannon Coulter writes, solar panels on the wall are like Ivanka Trump on the campaign trail. They are only there to hide the hate. You're watching DW News. Still to come on the program, Trump may be into solar energy now, but it's American oil that pushes prices down to seven-month lows across the globe. Investors worrying that oversupply will continue despite international efforts to cut production. All that and more in just a minute's time.
Stories that move people the world over. Information they provide. Opinions they want to express. DW on Facebook and Twitter. Up to date and in touch. Follow us. DW, true diversity. Where the world of science is at home in many languages. Our Innovations Magazine for Asia. Every week and always looking to the future on DW.com. Science and Research for Asia.
Welcome back. A quick reminder of our top story. The so-called Islamic State has blown up the iconic Al-Nouri Mosque in Mosul. The building was a landmark of the city for more than 800 years, and it is where IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared an Islamic caliphate in 2014. Oil is hitting new lows, and that has plenty of people worried. Daniel Winter is here to explain why. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Sarah. Yes, investors and producers alike, oil prices have reached a seven-month low on global markets. OPEC producers announced last year they were cutting production, but prices continue to fall. At the start of the year, Brent crude was heading up and selling for nearly $56 a barrel. But as oversupply continues, prices are heading south, with OPEC apparently powerless to control the market. This week, a barrel slipped below $45 all the way over here, even though exporters have slashed production by nearly 1.8 billion barrels a day. OPEC oil ministers continue to believe prices will stabilize once the cutbacks take full effect, but others have their doubts. Here's why.
A giant tanker ship full up with oil and no place to go. The number of brimming tankers bobbing on the world's oceans has reached a new high, one more indication of the crisis facing the oil industry. After OPEC announced production cuts late last year, oil prices began to rise above the $50 a barrel mark. But now it is beginning to look like a chronic problem, as oversupply and weak demand have pulled prices back down. In the United States, the fracking industry has come back in force. Some experts now believe that technology can still be profitable even if oil drops to below $40 a barrel. The volume of crude oil futures traded on global exchanges has been dropping steadily, a sure sign that many expect the price of oil will continue to fall.
Let's cross to the Frankfurt Stock Exchange now. Daniel, why is this new price fall happening now? I mean, we've known about OPEC's trouble cutting supply for a while.
Yeah, very interesting question. And actually, if you ask this question here on the floor, investors basically have two answers. On the one hand, they're saying that this might be linked to political uncertainty in oil-producing countries, such as Venezuela, for example. Others say that they don't really relate this to a certain timing at the moment. But of course, what basically everybody agrees, there's too much oil on the market. Libya, Nigeria, they don't really care what OPEC is saying. They need the cash and they're producing oil. On the other hand, also the United States, big with fracking, we heard it in the report, they are also not paying attention to OPEC. Of course, that raises the question, you know, which role OPEC is also going to play in the future.
OK, so really complex reasons behind this latest price drop. Now, oil has been seen as a barometer of global markets for a while now, of how the economy is performing across the world as well. Is that still the case?
Well, when you look at the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, but also at other stock markets around the world, basically, they were dropping this week, and many are relating this to the latest oil dropping price. But, of course, I mean, we remember the oil price used to be up with more than $140. By that time, also the blue chip index DAX didn't have basically the double value. So it's a little bit complicated to say that. Of course, the oil industry is a big industry with many jobs. You know, lots of money is because of the oil companies always happening. So that's, of course, a reason. But also, when you look here from the Frankfurt perspective, the reason why shares are are a little bit falling this week. It's also because there is not really a lot of things happening right now in the financial world. We don't have a big crisis. Brexit is still far away. So investors are also linking that to this reason. And maybe it's also because of the hot weather with 34 degrees outside that the blue chip index DAX is a little bit lazy in these days.
Well, investors are definitely sweating right now. Daniel Korp, thank you very much for that. Shares in Japanese airbag maker Takata continue to plummet in Tokyo, losing another 50% as fears mount that it will file for bankruptcy protection as soon as today. The company is now worth less than a quarter of what it was a week ago. Takata's defective airbags led to the largest ever safety recall in the car industry, nearly 100 million cars worldwide. The firm is now saddled with billions in liabilities, but says no decision has been made about bankruptcy. It seems Brexit is already having unintended consequences. One of Britain's favourite summer fruits is under threat, the strawberry. That's the warning coming from industry body British Summer Fruits. They say harvesting the beloved berry will be a lot more expensive in the future. 95% of the almost 30,000 seasonal workers in the UK are from elsewhere in the EU, and demand is only expected to rise. But with Brexit, the amount of foreign workers is set to decline, meaning the cultivation of the strawberry will drop too. Instead, Brits will have to import the punnets from abroad to feed their growing appetite. And that's it for your business news. I'm going to hand you back over to Sarah, who's got some more news for us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Daniel. Because today in Uganda, the United Nations are launching another global appeal for South Sudanese refugees. A donor, Submit in Kampala, hopes to raise $2 billion to provide urgent water, food and shelter. Now, previous calls for support have fallen short, with many nations not following through on their pledges. South Sudan's civil war has triggered the biggest refugee crisis on the African continent. Nearly 2 million people have fled the country since fighting broke out in 2013, half of them to neighboring Uganda. Now, Uganda has maintained an open border policy. It gives refugees plots of land and allows them freedom of movement, but the sheer number of new arrivals is testing the country's generosity.
They come with the little they could save from their homes. They come in their thousands. Every day. The border between South Sudan and Uganda is controlled, but officials there let all refugees through. Almost a million people have fled war and famine-ridden South Sudan for neighbouring Uganda. They arrive desperate and exhausted. Uganda has a model refugee policy. After being registered in a camp, most refugees are given a piece of land, like here in the north of the country. Maria Lalum and her grandchildren have been here since the beginning of the year. It's the third time I've had to leave my country. Firstly, because of the conflict with Sudan, and now this war. Both my children and my grandchildren were born in refugee camps. Only a really solid government could convince me to return to my home country. But I don't think that will happen in my lifetime. Despite the small piece of land, life here is hard. Maria Lalum has to get by with just 4 kilos of corn flour a week for 8 people. Still, after being separated while fleeing, the family is happy to just be together. After South Sudan gained independence in 2011, hopes for peace were high, but the people were to be bitterly disappointed when just 2 years later the country descended into civil war.
Our hope was for our development of our countries and to make the good relationship and the business along our neighbours, you see. But they have to really see the struggle of the people, the suffering.
Uganda's open door policy is increasingly proving a strain on the country. It now desperately needs international aid to cope with the new arrivals.
When you integrate refugees with the host population, you cannot discriminate. You want that ability to provide services to both host populations and the refugees at the same time. Given the economic situations in all our developing world countries, we are already struggling.
Water, for example, is in short supply in the north of the country. Adequate supplies of food, schools and medicine are needed for hundreds of thousands of people. But despite the strain, Uganda's door remains open to those in need.
In football, Germany continued their Confederations Cup campaign tonight when they take on Chile. Joachim Löw's team won their opening game against Australia, but the Copa America champions are sure to provide a sterner test for the players. It's an important match for Löw himself, too, with the coach closing in on a momentous achievement.
Yogi Löw has been running rings around opponents for 11 years, and now the Kazan Arena could be the scene of another milestone in his stunning career. Löw has led Germany to 99 victories. One more will take him to a historic century. I will certainly celebrate whenever it happens. It'll happen one day. If you have 100 victories to celebrate, it's better than having 100 defeats. The game against Chile will be the toughest task yet for Germany's experimental team. Löw is hoping his inexperienced players prove their mettle against the South American champions. It will certainly be the case that after this match we will have that experience, and some of the players will have gained the experience they'll need to play at this level against teams like Chile. Chile are the fourth best side in the world according to FIFA's rankings, one place behind Germany. But Bayern midfielder Arturo Vidal says that won't be on the players' minds. FIFA rankings will not mean anything in tomorrow's game. I think each game is unique, and we don't care so much about the ranking. I think the ranking is more for people who don't play soccer. Löw may hit the 100 mark tonight, but whatever happens, he'll learn an important lesson about his team.
A quick reminder now of the top story that we are following for you. The so-called Islamic State has blown up the iconic Al-Nuri Mosque in Mosul. The building was a landmark of the city for more than 800 years, and it's where IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared an Islamic caliphate in 2014. You're up to date. Thanks for watching.
Cordoba's patios open their doors to visitors only once a year. A flower is a flower, is a source of joy for every gardener. Rare glimpses into Spain's famous courtyards in our Gardens of Europe series.
Euromax, next on DW.
The rise of Islamic radicalization in a country known for its modern outlook. In rural northeast Bosnia, fundamentalist preachers are gaining ground.
The war's in Bosnia.
As their message spreads, liberal Muslims are sounding the alarm.
Focus on Europe in 60 Minutes on DW.
So dear, after years, still so clear. Live your favorite memory.